You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO at 102.7 FM.
This book began with, in a way, it began with the Quebec referendum. You all remember relatively recently. I had just moved to Vancouver, but I had lived in Quebec for 2 years, and I still had a vote. So I'm watching the results of the Quebec referendum. You remember the moment when it was yes, no, 50-50. And I said to Penny, actually, I was watching the results with her, I said, the future of Canada is resting on my shoulders. And I thought about that later. And this was a very embodied response. By then, I was studying affect theory, which is the study of embodied, passionate feeling within culture. And I started to notice the ways in which Canadian television helps to produce and perpetuate these kinds of passionate feelings around nation and nationalism. And I got very interested in that. So this was also the preoccupation of my PhD thesis. I started to research Canadian television, and to do that I had to go to the archive, the CBC television news archives. I spent a lot of time there, and the National Archives in Ottawa. I got really interested in the archive itself as a site of memory and as a site of forgetting. And so the first excerpt I'm going to read for you is about the archive. No matter how you hope to proceed, there is always the archive. You must obtain permission. It takes time to do this. You will be regarded with mild suspicion or perhaps bemusement. Your body will pass a metallic shadow through various security devices. You will enter a sterile, windowless room. You are going home as you do this, though you do not know it yet, an unheimlich home. You are returning to the place you thought you had left, where you have dwelt so uneasily, the space of the nation. You have spent days, even years, in this archive. You have spent your entire life there. It is an archive of memories, fantasies, and spectral presences, a site of regulation, but also of desire. A newscaster in a skinny tie grimly announces a hostage-taking in Montreal, October 1970. Pierre Trudeau, in cinematic medium close-up shrugs, mutters, "Just watch me." Switch channels and decades through a semiotic chain. Fidel Castro watches patiently as Justin Trudeau delivers a eulogy to his father, October 2000. Look away for a moment and they're gone. A flurry of white dresses fills the screen. It's August 1957. Friends and neighbors, how are you? It's a real pleasure to have you with us tonight, drawls country hoedown host Gordy Tapp, live from a hay bale strewn set in downtown Toronto. Fiddler King Ganem winks roguishly at the camera. You can hear American folk music sung by Canadian country singers, the Haynes sisters with their identical dresses and thick harmonies, a very young, tall Tommy Hunter earnestly singing, "Teenage love is a losing game." East Europeans sneak in by virtue of their fiddle playing and passing as white skin. Eddie Gerke from Woodstock, Ontario, with Coke bottle glasses, cowboy shirt, and cowlick, wins the fiddle playing challenge. Lorraine Foreman sings the melodious words of a square dance caller. Ladies in the lead, that's Injun style. She puts her hand up, miming a feather behind her head, and swing that gal behind you. You are at the archive. You have finally gained entry. Nostalgia fills the air. You feel a kind of pride as these ghostly images flicker in front of you. You know that the other side of this pride is shame. For archives, as Sarah Ahmed has pointed out, are also affective contact zones. So, this is an academic book, but it's I tried to write it in an anecdotal style, or what Jane Gallup has called anecdotal theory. So I try to tell stories at the same time that I try to analyze. And part of what I felt to be my task in the book was to look at television, the content of Canadian television critically. Canadian television's actually been little analyzed in terms of its content. We're all familiar with Marshall McLuhan and his notion of the medium, the technology, as being the important thing to study. And so Canadian television theory has always been characterized by the study of technology and policy. We've had less opportunity to study content, and partly because the archive is so inaccessible, so partial, so fragmented. But nonetheless, being in the archive was an effective contact zone for me. I felt a lot of, I had a lot of different feelings, nostalgia, pride. There's ways in which we get drawn into nationalism despite ourselves. And there are times when I felt a sort of shame for some of the problematic aspects of our history and culture, which I will get into. Okay, so I'm going to read to you from different sections of the book. I'm going to try and lighten things up a little bit now and move to some more anecdotal material. As in almost all my books, I make use of my family for comedic content. They don't mind. They've gotten used to it. They're resigned to it. My mother is my muse. She appears in all of my work. Somehow. I was, you know, when this was still a manuscript, I said to her, Ma, I should probably read to you some of the passages from this book because you're in it. She's like, why wouldn't I be in it? Like, it's about Canadian TV. Why wouldn't I be in it? So I'm going to read to you from a chapter. I have a chapter about the genre of the cooking show. I love, who here doesn't love the Food Channel? I don't know if anyone here remembers Galloping Gourmet, but this was a cooking show, a Canadian cooking show from the 1970s, featuring Graham Kerr. I'm actually not going to be talking about him, but when I was at the National Archives, I saw several of those shows. He was our Nigella Lawson. We were pioneers in the sort of sexualized cooking shows genre. But here I write about a Canadian cooking show called Loving Spoonfuls, which originated out of Winnipeg, actually, and focused on ethnic grandmothers. And I don't really talk that much about it in this excerpt, but my mother is the kind of the figure that leads me into discussion of this show. And I also discussed it with her, and she helped me to figure out a different way of looking at it. In the heady early days of official Canadian multiculturalism, my mother, like many of her generation of Ukrainian immigrants, became an unofficial publicist for all things Ukrainian. One January, she called up all of her media contacts, and she did have media contacts, to inform them that January 6th was the real Christmas for East Europeans the world over, and therefore a news item. In point of fact, we celebrated both Christmases in a desultory fashion, each by half. The two halves never quite made up a whole, and it was perhaps these unsuccessful faux celebrations that made my mother want to produce and direct her own. Fair enough. But I hadn't anticipated that my mother would have a stand-in daughter for the media version. Maria. A girl from our church, and a second-generation Ukrainian, blissfully free of the sullen resentment and ethnic shame that we children of immigrants possessed. Maria loved being Ukrainian. She was earnestly and smugly proud of it. She appeared at our door at the appointed time, immaculately made up and coiffed in full ethnic regalia, embroidered blouse, tunic, skirt, and flowered headdress. My mother promptly seated her at the front window along with my little sister, Lydia, who'd reluctantly agreed to be similarly displayed. I was relegated to the kitchen to chop cabbage and beets. The camera crews were ordered outside for a better shot, and the next day on the local news, there was Maria with an annoyed 5-year-old Lydia on her lap, solemnly looking out of the window of our suburban house for the first star, after which, according to my mother's apocryphal telling, the family would sit down to eat. Of course, it was a complete construction. After that overly lighted tableau was dismantled, my father bellowed his disgust. I went and sulked in my room, and the sacred meal got cold. Media images, of course, are never real, and my mother understood this well. Whatever it was she was selling required a double, a stand-in, someone less foreign and more hyper-real, who could soften the grotesque edges of the immigrant's existence and yet, ironically, satisfy the audience's desire for the authenticity of the native. One might assume that the picture in the paper was less for us and more for a white Anglo reader immersed in nostalgia for lost ethnic multicultural ontologies. But then, you know, I actually talked about this with my mother, and we talked about this show, which I'm not going to read to you about, Loving Spoonfuls, and I started to reach a different conclusion. So I write, I wish to also argue that the boundaries of multiculturalist representation are also horizons of possibility. If several scholars suggest, pleasure and shame are inextricably connected, can the guilty yet somehow shameful pleasures of indulging in one's own stereotypes, as seen on TV, lead to some new ideas about the immigrant self? Following current cultural studies theory, Apa Dirai, in writing about the intersections of media and migration, describes electronic media as, quote, resources for experiments in self-making, end quote. Migrant representations, he argues, produce images and viewers not easily bound within local, national, or regional spaces. For nationalism, as he points out, is now itself diasporic. Can certain ethnic representations, such as those on the Canadian cooking show Loving Spoonfuls, provide valuable insights into the transnational diasporic subject? Well, to find out, you'll have to buy the book. I'm not going to tell you how that ends. So as I said, affect is a contact zone. We have only to think of royal weddings, state funerals, or the Oscars this weekend, this Sunday. You know, these are very important televisual moments. In television geek theory, we call it moments of simultaneous viewing, when people sort of have a sense of unity in one way or another, whether it's through a banal or ironic appreciation of popular culture, or sometimes, as with the Olympics, and I know that's a delicate topic here, people actually are drawn into a kind of ersatz community of nation. So I have a chapter where I write about the Trudeau funeral from 2000, which I found to be a very interesting kind of moment of simultaneous television viewing, a time of grief, pleasure, nostalgia, a moment when, you know, this happens a lot with state funerals, people find a sense of belonging, whether or not they are grieving for the celebrity themselves, somehow sites of feeling, whether it's grief for their own losses, are evoked. So I'm going to read you an excerpt from the chapter on the Trudeau funeral. Again, it's a little less about the Trudeau funeral, this excerpt, and more about my own memories and flashbacks that were evoked by the Trudeau funeral. Actually, I'll start with yet another little anecdote about my mother. As a child in the 1970s, I was too young for Trudeau mania. My mother, in her late 30s, was perhaps a tad too old. Nonetheless, it was from her mouth and through my ears that I experienced this particular affect that was sweeping the nation. Trudeau mania is the name popularly given to the extraordinary public appeal of Pierre Elliott Trudeau, Canada's 15th Prime Minister, and is thought to have lasted from Trudeau mania is thought to have lasted from approximately 1968 to 1972. And this is a description of Trudeau mania, which is very very embodied, this description, by George Radwanski, writing in a biography about Trudeau. In an election campaign that often seemed like a joyous coronation, crowds gathered by the tens of thousands, not to hail his past accomplishments, but simply to see the man, and preferably to touch him. Wherever he met, he was mobbed like a pop star, fingers grasped towards him for a handshake, a touch, or a snatched souvenir. At one stop, his watch was ripped from his wrist, and late in the campaign, pubescent girls took to trying to pluck hairs from his balding head. Touch, proximity, and the contagion of manic excitement are all ways in which affect manifests as collective national sentiment. In this chapter, I examine Trudeau mania and the televised state funeral of Pierre Trudeau as phenomena in which the body, affect, and ideas about the nation intersected. Trudomania has been classified as interest and excitement, but to me it sounded like pure delight, a strangely thrilling mix of glamour and patriotism, the distant and the proximate flashing across the surface of my mother's white teeth and Max Factor red lips. My Ukrainian immigrant mama always looked and sounded beautiful when she spoke French, and so it was when she repeated what Pierre Elliott Trudeau had said to her at a parliamentary reception. Je suis enchantée de faire votre connaissance. My mother learned French from the nuns at her convent school in a small Franco-Albertan town. That convent, she always said, was like heaven for me. But my mother's piety is transformed into bubbly patriotism the day she met Trudeau. That Mama could shake hands with a prime minister, that mother tongue could become so enchanted was enough of Trudeau-mania for me. Then and there I resolved to speak French someday, and the word Trudeau became one of pleasure, promise, and opportunity. But of course there was a dark side to Trudeau. In the coverage of the funeral, this was sometimes overlooked. So in this chapter, I flash back to the October crisis of 1970, which was, I believe now, the second largest mass arrest in Canadian history, the G20 now taking priority for that. So in this book, as in a lot of my work, I try to uncover some of these kind of forgotten or unspoken moments in Canadian history. So this chapter is called The Driveways of the Nation. And I also, in this chapter, controversially for some, talk about Trudeau's sort of queer acting persona and the sort of queerness in terms of queer as outlaw or non-normal, the queerness of his funeral. But this excerpt doesn't really get into that. So anyways, The Driveways of the Nation. There was a strange proximity to the October crisis of 1970 in our modestly middle-class Ottawa neighborhood. First, there was the television sputtering earnestly in black and white, mugshots of the FLQ, Front de Libération du Québec, cell members with their flowery names, Rose and Cosette, and Trudeau in gunslinger mode playing to the camera. And second, there was my neighborhood and the presence of army tanks on our very own street with its own flowery name, Featherston Drive. I was in grade 7 and seriously working on my popularity. I had never felt more self-conscious, more watched by my eagle-eyed mom, by mirrors and reflections in store windows, by girls and by boys. I had just started to be courted by a group of bad girls who invited me to allegedly girls-only basement sleepovers where boys were daringly smuggled in like contraband long after the moms and dads had gone to bed. Spin the bottle and long, boring bouts of necking now occupied the site where girl talk, Ouija boards, and makeup sessions had once deliciously reigned. Those kisses felt interminable to me, unpracticed boyish lips like wet washcloths, skin that smelled like running shoes. Mouths again, but without language this time, or perhaps it was a completely new language that I could never inhabit, but which for many years I would try desperately to speak. It was at one of those awkward basement parties that we heard about Quebec Labour Minister, or Minister of Unemployment, as the FLQ dubbed him, Pierre Laporte's assassination on someone's pink transistor radio. Was it before or after that tanks rolled into our neighborhood to protect some low-level diplomat living in one of the colonial-style prefabs that lined the treeless street? As I wrote later in a film narration, in our suburban Ottawa neighborhood, everything seemed so calm. Army tanks were parked in front of some of the better homes, and the moms brought the soldiers coffee or tea. When the dads came home, family snapshots were taken in front of the tanks, which had very quickly become status symbols. Clearly, we were protected, with or without the tanks, by our whiteness and innocence, by our willingness to speak English, by the size of our very green lawns. Perhaps we also felt protected by Trudeau, whose masculinity and paternalism were suddenly no longer in question. On some level, I could relate. I, too, had just left behind an innocent same-sex milieu. The state had been banished from the bedrooms of the nation, only to reappear in its driveways. The world would never be quite the same again. Okay, so stuff happens when you write a book. While I was writing this, 9/11 happened and the rise of conservative ideology in Canada and around the world. I had the curious experience as I was doing research for this book of going to the CBC News Archives a year after 9/11 and looking at all of the CBC news coverage of 9/11 without the sort of shock and trauma of experiencing it on the day. So I looked at, you know, what we call speech acts and ways of framing the event that became increasingly ideological as the days after 9/11 wore on. And so I talk in the book also about the ways in which racial profiling happened, not just in the U.S. and Canada, and in part through the ways in which televisual discourse was organized. Because affect is so associative, I think many people experienced sort of associative feelings with 9/11, as we do with many kind of current events and world tragedies. So in this book, I also write about an experience of loss in my own family that happened around that time. And this excerpt is called Impossible Citizens, after a poem by Dion Brand. Anniversaries recur with their deep, compulsive need to repeat the trauma of loss. In the wake of the various tragedies of 9/11, the telling and retelling of the story becomes a way to return to an emotional ground zero, to the home place of grief. As I attempt to watch a week's worth of anniversary footage of 9/11, I finally reach a necessary limit. It's not just that the documentaries, the interviews, the reflections have been harnessed to the service of Bush's invasion of Iraq. It's also that it's only 2 months since a death in my own family. The faces of New Yorkers mourning the loss of their husbands, wives, daughters, and brothers are suddenly familiar to me. They look like my face or the face of my mother. The television has become a mirror machine, and I have reached a limit of skin stretched taut, connecting New Yorkers' experience to mine, connecting theory and affect, private and personal. My brother, my father, my grandmother, my own dad, my flesh and blood, my skin and kin. The unrepresentable real has folded into the reality of personal grief. Theory for here, affect for there, layers of skin on skin, multiple points of connection to justice, to power, to sentiment, to a false collectivity, to community, to the repetitive, compulsive home place of grief. My deceased brother's body is returned to his birthplace for burial, to a sun-bleached plot of prairie land. His real home place was in Vancouver's downtown east side. The downtown east side provided for my brother, as for many others, a site of ethics and community built from the ground of trauma. The grid of 8 scarred city blocks amid which he lived is a place of roots shallowly but firmly placed, of memories of origin that rise in dreams and drug-induced hallucinations, like hands choking throats or like something someone else dreamed for you. Like de Certeau's Wanderer's Man, my brother played music on and walked the city's streets and alleys daily, obsessively, one of those whose, quote, bodies follow the thicks and thins of an urban text, end quote. But this was a text that, despite his daily presence in it, could not include him in its syntax, its organization. Impossible citizen, Vichnaya Pamyat, eternal memory, eternal unbelonging. And then I end the chapter this way. Television, purveyor of ghost stories across the borders of inside and outside, made of each home a mirrored house of horrors. This home, as I have shown, was achieved through the demonization of migrants and immigrants crossing borders. Television and its appendages played a large role in this. At the same time, the desire for home, for roots, for fixed and stable meanings as a function of a pre-linguistic psychic space came to the fore. People couldn't find words for what had happened. Instead, they sought security, a stable place, longed for a fullness and completeness, the only recourse during both 9/11 and the 2002 Olympic Winter Games seemed to be escape to the larger home of nation. Okay, I'm going to end with what I hope is a sort of hopeful passage. I conclude the book by trying to imagine a home that is post-national, that isn't mired in the problems and the conservatism of nationalism. And also what happened when I wrote this book was the rise of social media, the rise of citizen journalism, and an increasing movement between and across platforms, so that people are no longer fixed in one sort of site of reception, but are moving critically, I hope, across various news sites and sources. So I write a little bit about that. I also, there's a reference in this passage to the Joe Canadian rant, the infamous ad for Molson beer, which is sort of a leitmotif for this book, and you can kind of see that in the colors used by the designer and the different images which refer to the Joe Canadian rant. So I start by talking about a trip to Ukraine as a way to talk about belonging and unbelonging. It's called Movements Between and Across. I didn't ever feel at home in Kiev, Ukraine. Nothing matched my father's memories or my grandmother's stories, not the architecture, not the language, not even the food. I stopped referring to myself as Ukrainian, for that only confused people. Instead, I learned to describe myself in both Ukrainian and English as simply diaspora, which is how others in Ukraine referred to me. As I walked the wide, leafy boulevards of Kiev, I could feel the proper boundaries of skin and identity eroding. I was becoming a diasporic subject, something between East and West, something that would either never belong in either or would always long for one or the other. Sarah Ahmed describes the space in between homes as a space of belonging. A new generation of anti-globalization and anti-war activists call transnational communities home. For many Canadian youth, an ironic appreciation of myth, still rooted in consumption, takes the place of overt displays of nationalism. Origin has become unheimlich, and destination is always unstable. Home represents an impossible yet yearned-for future rather than a stable past. As I traveled by train and bus through the scarred social and geographic landscape of Ukraine, I wondered if my elders' recollections of the old country had been mere projection. Where were the lush green steppes and hallowed birch groves we had sung about as children? National narratives, as I argued earlier, compensate for the failure of individual memory. National narratives become undone in the space in between. I've come to the conclusion that the ethical becoming of mourning or working through occurs across media. In an age of convergence, television can no longer be spoken of in isolation from other media. Audiences develop their own latent forms of media interactivity and meaning-making that the creators of those media may not have envisioned, like tweeting as a way to organize political intervention. Riposte, commentary, humor, scathing critique are all available on the internet, rabble.ca, Znet, frontlines.com, even YouTube. On the CBC, the now-defunct CBC News World program Inside Media, a black campus radio host says his ethnic audiences shun CBC TV, not necessarily because of racism, but because of what he calls its polite Anglo sound. He considers Radio 3, CBC's now also defunct youth-oriented online presence, to be a much cooler and culturally diverse location. Such sites collude with the latest in digital consumption, laptop computers, scanners, CD and DVD burners, downloads, cell phone text messaging systems, social networking sites, blogging programs, online software shimmering with ads. Nonetheless, Canadian TV scholars Beattie and Sullivan posit some interesting affective flows emerging from new technologies when they write, "The face of television is changing from the classic model in which images flow from the screen to a mass audience. In its place is a model that finds the flow originating with audience itself, as they deftly manipulate the fullest limits of the medium and adapt it to their needs. This mastery of scheduling, format, and site of reception unique to audiences of digital media opens up possibilities for affect to circulate among bodies as audiences share digital downloads in sites less vulnerable to government regulation or corporate influence. Canadian television becomes more fluid, more interactive at the borders of media. The Molson's website bulletin board is an unwitting site of resistance, as when an anonymous writer declaims in response to Joe Canadian's rants. I want my identity back, because my country's identity has sold its soul to corporate power, because consumerism and beer consumption has become our national religion, because we have forgotten the true meaning of being Canadian, and because Canadian now means a beer. I am not a demographic. I am not a consumer. I am who I am, and I am not a beer. Thank you.
So any questions or comments from you would be welcome. And Marussia, I have one for you, and it's to do with Canadian TV. What are you watching these days? And is there anything happening on Canadian TV that's, you know, that's piqued your interest and is going to be showing up in Volume 2 of Feeling Canadian?
Wow, that's a good question. A hard question. I think Canadian television is, I teach a course on Canadian TV, and actually my students kind of teach me too, because they're watching stuff I'm not watching, and they're noticing stuff I might not necessarily have picked up on. And what's happening now, I mean, Canada has a very strong export market in Canadian TV, so what's happening with a lot of, with most actually Canadian TV shows now, is that they don't have any visible Canadian elements, because that makes it easier for them to be exported. So shows like Being Erica or, my mind's gone blank, but Republic of Doyle. I mean, actually Newfoundland is doing something different, I have to say. I think Republic of Doyle, good example. I think it does both. I think it's both regional and sort of transnational. So it means that those sort of banal Canadian signifiers are less present in Canadian TV these days. Degrassi is another example. Degrassi tries to be both American and Canadian at the same time. So it's very interesting to watch this going on and also to watch audiences who still locate themselves as national and still identify, especially Degrassi with my students, identify those shows as Canadian at the same time that they have disavowed Canadian content. So, globalization produces some interesting kind of counterflows. We might not completely support its economic project, but what it does to processes of identity making are interesting.